You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Les Leopold writes in his new book that for the past few years, he's had a morbid curiosity about exotic financial instruments, especially collateralized debt obligations. And what he remains certain of these two things, that the root cause of the financial collapse wasn't because of low-income homebuyers and their subprime mortgages. He names what he feels are the real culprits in the title of his new book, The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. It's published by Chelsea Green Publishing, and I'm very pleased that it brings Les Leopold to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Did one event in particular prompt you to write this book?
A little bit. I had come across these exotic financial instruments that everybody said were too complicated to understand.
And how much did you know about the financial world before you began?
Not much. What I knew came by osmosis through my fellow soccer dads in suburban New Jersey who happened to work in Wall Street. And I have a little bit of an economics background, and my forte is trying to explain complicated things in more simple language. So I thought, this is an interesting topic. Why don't I look at these exotic financial instruments? Along the way, two things really struck me. One, there was this town above the Arctic Circle in Norway called Narvik that bought these things and lost 40% of their treasury. And we've been to Norway a few times. I have great sympathy for them. And I wonder, how the heck did this happen? Then the town right next to where my in-laws live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the town of Whitefish Bay, and four other towns bought $200 million worth of these exotic instruments to kind of help the school district, and they lost more than 99% of their value. So I said, holy cow, what's going on? So I started to explore it, and I really got into it, and I realized they were too hard for me to understand, so I put it down.
And then you said you thought it was time for you to figure it out and share it with my fellow ignoramuses.
Right.
But let's talk about Whitefish Bay. That's pretty far from Wall Street. What kind of town is it?
It's a very well-heeled town. It's on the coast of Lake Michigan, high on these bluffs, beautiful homes along the coast. Upper middle class, upper class, solid community, cares about its schools, would never do anything to harm its kids. Everybody goes to college, that kind of town.
And the school district is the source of this problem? They invested with a Stifel Nicholas and Company?
That they did. They bought something that they didn't understand. The person selling it to them didn't understand it either. I listened carefully to the tapes of the board meetings, and it was a phenomenal blind leading the blind off a cliff, much like the economy as a whole.
And what was he asking the school? This is a man named Daniel Nowak. Right?
Correct.
What was he asking the school district to do?
They needed funds for what they call a post-retiree benefit fund for their employees, and it was a liability that they wanted to fund over a long period of time. So he thought he'd come up with a way for them to basically build up a trust fund by borrowing money and basically making more money than the cost of borrowing. And over time, this would be the goose that laid the golden egg, alchemy.
Synthetic collateralized debt obligation. How does that differ from your usual collateralized debt obligation?
Well, I don't want to take your listeners down a long, dangerous track here, but basically what it was they bought an insurance policy. They got, they paid $200 million to insure the junk debt of the Royal Bank of Canada. That's what they
The Royal Bank of Canada, I would think, is a really solid institution.
It is, but the junk debt, to this day, there's a big court case going on. We still don't know whether or not they insured anything that's real. In other words, the Royal Bank of Canada, it may not even have been their debt that was insured. So for the privilege of insuring that debt, which was, they were told was AA, AAA rated, in fact, it was junk debt, they paid a fee up front of $11.5 million. They didn't know they did that. That was built into the security. And they basically don't have any tangible assets. They bought nothing real.
So the fee, the $11 million, no matter what happened, that was gone.
Right off the top.
Even if they earned a lot of money from this.
Gone.
You say synthetic CDOs are among the most complex derivatives ever designed. Are they complex, designed to be complex to confuse us?
I don't think they were designed specifically for that reason. They were designed to do the following. And for this to make sense, allow me to just back up and put this in a bigger context. 30 years ago, we embarked on this very, very bold experiment in the United States, and it included two parts. One was the deregulation of finance, so it no longer was encapsulated in the New Deal controls. The other was a change in the tax structure. It was we used to have very punitive taxes on the top fraction of the population, 70-90% during the Eisenhower years. It was brought way down. The idea was the combination of the two would lead to this fantastic financial innovation and a huge investment boom in the real economy. In fact, what happened was very different. The average three things happened. The average real wage, instead of going up like it had been going up since World War II, peaked and started to go down. It's actually 18% less now than it was during the mid-1970s for the average non-supervisory production worker, about 100 million people. The money did, in fact, go to the investment class, but they actually ran out of real-world investments.
But it went to the investment class, and that was supposed to lead to trickle-down economics.
Here's what it led to. In 1970, the ratio of the top 100 CEOs to the average worker was 45 to 1. Okay, it's not socialism, but it's a wage gap, 45 to 1. Guess what it was by 2006?
It's got to be in the hundreds.
1,723 to 1. 1723 to 1. That's some change.
Ayn Rand must be thrilled.
There was a huge amount of money then in the hands of a few people who were hungry for investments. The normal investments in goods, in bonds and stocks and treasury notes, those yields were going down. So there was a huge demand for higher rates of return. Wall Street, now unleashed, came up with these new instruments. And their genius was that they thought they found a way to package large quantities of risky debt, get a high rate of return, take the risk out of them, and make these investors happy.
What did people like Ben Bernanke and Warren Buffett think about these synthetic CDOs?
Well, Ben Bernanke was, I believe, of the Alan Greenspan school, which was a deregulated market would police itself. If these securities were bad, they would wither on the vine and die. Warren Buffett now, I don't know what he said back then, but now he's saying they're financial weapons of mass destruction that should never have been unleashed on the marketplace.
Well, part of the problem is that the buyers of these investments don't receive a stake in the corporation that they're investing in, as they would if they were buying a stock or a bond. They're buying. What are they buying exactly?
They're buying a bet. This is where it really gets wild. This is why I call it fantasy finance. And I honestly think that if anybody, people will find that if they take a look at Looting of America, they actually will feel empowered to understand how this works. It's once you can make a bet, once you and I can bet on a corporation that neither you and I have an ownership stake in it, then we can bet on anything. We can set up financial securities that have no relationship, tangible relationship to an asset.
Didn't certain gambling laws have to be unenacted to allow for this to happen?
Actually, a whole lot of laws had to be unenacted. Gambling, but of course this is finance, it's not gambling. And second of all, insurance, because a credit default swap is just another name for insurance. But if you call an insurance, it's regulated.
Now, a caller asks, what responsibility does the buyer have in all of this? You should understand the products that you're buying. And especially if you're investing millions and millions of other people's money.
Look, the school district people who bought this stuff obviously feel awful about it, feel stupid. Several of them have been wiped out of office. But, you know, this is not new.
But they not only put up their millions, they borrowed millions more to insure the $20 billion worth of debt.
Right. They borrowed $200 million and now have lost it all, and they still owe the $200 million, and there's a big court case over it. But, you know, this is not the first time that this has happened with public agencies. Orange County, which happened, 10 years earlier, was also turned out to be a total, basically a rape of the public treasury. And we as a country, I believe, are obliged to protect our public agencies from these ripoffs.
Did the whole thing fall apart last year when the meltdown occurred, or is this something that would have happened no matter what?
Oh, this had to melt down at some point, because basically what we had created, or what had been created, was an upside down pyramid sitting on top of very risky assets. As soon as those assets lost a little bit of value, stopped going up, subprime mortgages, for example, as soon as housing prices stopped their rocket-like ascent, once they leveled off, it meant the value of all those supposedly scientific securities that were fantasy sitting on top of them, they lost value. So it multiplied the effect and caused a crash.
And this has led to a group called the Wisconsin Five. Why are they called that?
Oh, I call them that. They don't call themselves that. There are five school districts that are suing.
So this is five school districts alone in Wisconsin, and we're now, and we can assume, you mentioned Orange County, but we can assume this is something that's happened around the country one way or another?
Well, there's a big case now going on of a different kind of ripoff of the Birmingham County district also got these fantasy, a different version of fantasy finance. The point is, we deregulated the financial sector. It led to a mushrooming of these securities that basically had fictitious value, led to an enormous, this was, by the way, the most profitable sales operation in the history of Wall Street.
Well, somebody made a lot of money here.
Huge amount of money. The 3 years before the crash, the 19 largest banks made $300 billion. Half of that, you figure, goes to bonuses. In 3 months after the crash, they lost all that money, but they didn't give it back. They got to keep it. And now they're making record bonuses again.
I'm speaking with Les Leopold, who co-founded and directs two nonprofit educational organizations, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. And he has written a number of books. The most recent, the one we are discussing, is called The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. It is published by Chelsea Green. Stay with us for more. We're back with Les Leopold. His book, The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It, published by Chelsea Green. Another listener asked, what do you know about the value of the ratings companies such as Standard & Poor's and their complicity in all of this? Shouldn't they have rated these CDOs?
Oh, sure they should have, but the whole game really was rigged. You got to remember, we were on high finance was viewed as the future of America. It was way more profitable to produce this stuff than a refrigerator or a car. We were going to lead the world in financial engineering. And, of course, the rating agencies, who get paid by the big banks, went along with it. They did not have the capability to dissect these things in any meaningful way. And besides, everybody's data was based on what was going on for the last 20 years, and there hadn't been this kind of crash.
So to some degree, the culpability is spread all over the place.
Yeah, but I think it's a mistake to view it that way. This is a problem of the free market experiment in the financial sector.
But for example, it is a bipartisan problem because
absolutely.
We've seen this whole thing being the result of both Democratic and Republican votes to deregulate and to allow this sort of thing. And the Clinton administration, as well as the Bush administration, encouraged these sorts of things. Alan Greenspan, who now is receiving so much of the blame for this current situation, was a hero during the Clinton administration.
Absolutely right. Matter of fact, we can even go back to the Carter administration. The deregulation of credit card interest rates, taking the cap off, that was 1978. Oh, yes, that's bipartisan. But what we have to focus on is the free market concept does not work in high finance. It is inevitable going to lead to a crash. And second of all, what's really driving this is the distribution of income. When you let the distribution of income get out of hand, you get a crash, which is what happened in 1928 and 29 as well.
In your chapter, The Iron Law of Fantasy Finance, you go on to discuss the relationship of productivity and workers' wages. How does this come into play when we're talking about the economic collapse?
Oh, this is a shocking story. Between World War II and the mid-1970s, productivity and real wages after inflation tracked perfectly. Every year after year, productivity went up and real wages went up. That was the story of the great middle class that was created in the post-World War II period. By the mid-70s and towards the late 70s, once this experiment started, those two lines broke apart. Real wages stagnated and went flat and started to decline, but productivity still went up. It's gone up 90% since then. Who got the benefits of productivity? That's real money. That's not funny money. Who got it? It went to the top fraction of the 1%. Matter of fact, this year, the calculation for how much productivity workers didn't get is something like $3 trillion.
And is one of the reasons that minimum wage increases don't keep up with inflation?
There are a whole host of reasons.
The decline of unions in this
decline
country?
Of unions, the atrophy of the minimum wage, push for globalization to put workers in competition with lower wage workers around the world, the decimation of the labor law, on and on and on.
And you write there are 94.6 million non-supervisory workers who earn less than the average worker in 1973, and they're not getting their fair share of the spoils of their increased productivity.
Not even close.
What kind of work are we talking about here?
I'm talking about basically anybody who makes something out in the economy, works in a factory, works in an office, but isn't a supervisor.
But aren't those jobs being lost in our economy anyway?
Yeah, there's still 94 million of them, so we better take note.
And then we have this unemployment rate hitting 10.2%, or as some people would suggest, it's closer to 17%.
The official BLS, what they call the U6 jobless rate, is 17.5%. And it's still rising. And it's again, you can see the failure of our model still at work. We are banking on the private sector banks to put money into the economy, and they're not doing it.
The Obama administration is being criticized both left and right for not doing enough or not doing the right thing.
Yes, they are, and I'm afraid they are earning it. They adopted a theory that the only way out of the mess was to build up investor confidence. So they showered Wall Street with a huge amount of bailout money, not just TARP, but all kinds of asset guarantees, somewhere between $1 and $13 trillion. They asked for very little in return.
They're getting very little.
They're getting nothing in return. The banks, see, they're very interesting. They're actually showing a lot more gumption than I thought that they would. They're literally using our TARP money to lobby against things like the Consumer Protection Financial, the new agency that they're talking about. They're lobbying against controls on these financial weapons of mass destruction. The very ones that brought down the economy, they still want them deregulated.
What about the administration's wanting to create a green economy with an emphasis on shovel-ready projects? Shouldn't that be bringing new jobs?
Yeah, but not enough. You know, I was standing on the dock of Olympia, Washington, not long ago, and there were two products on that dock, very small port. We were exporting raw logs, and we were importing from Brazil 70-foot-long wind turbine blades. So unless we do something about globalization, we're not going to have an internal green economy. It's also going to be exported.
But that's because most of the economy has shifted from industrial production to the service industry, which is historically much harder to organize into unions, for example. And so
we've seen
the decline there. And that's because I'm assuming people tend to think that those jobs are temporary, whereas when they got those old jobs at General Motors, they thought they were being hired for life.
Well, look, we have an attitude towards workers and towards employment that's far different, let's say, than Germany. Germany is an export economy. They do everything they can to protect every single industrial job they have. They don't let them go. We blow them away. That's our belief that the free enterprise, unregulated economy is going to benefit us all. But unfortunately, we're learning the hard way that when we let the financial sector rule the entire economy, it's going to be dismantled. We are paying dearly for that misconception.
A listener, Stuart from Long Island, was a vice president for Bank One, which is now part of J.P. Morgan Chase. And he says the type of deals you're talking about were direct debt deals. There were other deals set up specifically to make money for the investment banks, and the banks made millions on the deals. The IRS found them years later to be fraudulent, going all the way back to 1990. The Wisconsin deals we've been talking about are just later variations.
Well, I'm certain that's true. But when you have an army of financial engineers, very high-paid, bright Sharpies, who do nothing else but figure out how to get around the latest law, they'll do so.
Should we put Stuart on the air? Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard. really enjoy your show all the time, and I just have to jump in on this one. This is I happen to know a lot about this. I was actually the trustee on those Wisconsin deals.
Oh, you got to be kidding! Watch what you say; you might get deposed.
Well, actually, that would be fine.
Were you upset about them at the time, or did you understand completely what was going on?
Actually, the ones that were set up prior to that were the ones that I was very, very disturbed about, because essentially what they did is the investment banks, there are certain governmental agencies, like in New York here, people will know, they'll see the dormitory authority will have a sign outside a hospital that, you know, the funding for this was from the New York State Dormitory Authority. So what they do is they have authorities that have a borrowing power, and what they do is they go out, for example, and they say, okay, the hospitals need so much money to build, new wings, buy new equipment, et cetera. No bank's going to lend them money. So what they do is they raise money and then act as a bank to these various hospitals. And the idea is, obviously, you know, they're trying to take care of the people of New York State. They do this in other states also. And these, under certain conditions, are non-taxable. So therefore, you can issue these at lower interest rates. Unfortunately, the way they're set up is there are all kinds of fees that exist over the entire term of the loan to protect the bondholders. These are not paid by payments directly from the hospitals. The money is loaned to them, and it's treated as either a lease payment or a loan payment back. And what they do is they don't pay use the money directly from these. They pay with a letter of credit, and then they reimburse the letter of credit. And this letter of credit generates enormous fees for the letter of credit provider, millions of dollars over the life of the, say, $130 million pool. They call it a pooled financing. There are remarketing fees that are paid constantly. There's the initiation fees. There are other fees. The fees during the low interest rate period, early 2000s, were 3, 4, 5, and 6 times the actual interest payments. So the fees were constantly just pouring into these banks.
Wait, Stuart. So you're saying that the system was designed for everybody to get a piece of the action, because everybody got a fee.
That's
no matter
right.
whatever happened, everybody was going to get a fee.
That's right.
So
and
they were guaranteed some payment, you know, whether the investor made any money was irrelevant.
Oh, the investor, nobody cared. The investor was getting, 0.3%. And the hospitals, I had CFOs of these hospitals come back and said, they'd rather let the hospital go bankrupt than ever take a loan like this again. And then what happened is, there were certain requirements. Let's say you borrowed $150 million under this bond issue. You had to lend out 95% of it within 3 years, because that's the IRS is giving you a break on this on certain, requirements. Well, there was one deal. They borrowed $130 million, then added $20 million to it, and they lent out, I believe it was $400,000 over the first 3 years. So all the fees were generated, and monies were made by the investment banks, and no benefit came to any of the hospitals because they couldn't meet the terms and conditions of the loans.
Well, look, I think what we really need to get very, very clear here is everything you're describing would not have been possible during the New Deal. It was precisely because we destroyed that entire regulatory regime.
Absolutely.
That this game could take place.
And people did see it. You mentioned that James Bothwell, in 1994, James Bothwell, on behalf of the General Accounting Office, predicted the financial meltdown 14 years before it happened.
Right. They were they understood that these, what I call the fantasy finance instruments, were getting out of hand because the value was mushrooming from like, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars into the trillions. And they knew there were only a few players. And you had like, it was like a poker game. If you're playing poker and a lot of money is changing hands and one of the people who's losing the most money at the table goes bankrupt, the whole table goes bankrupt. And if that table's connected to other tables, that the other tables go bankrupt. Bothwell saw this. He said, hey, if one of these large institutions that are underwriting all these things goes under, we're going to have an economic crash.
Absolutely. I was brought in to read some documents in 2002, I believe it was, on one of these ABS deals because I have a specific expertise in interpretation of these documents. And I dropped a 1,200-page document in front of me, and I looked at the guy like he's, you know, he's insane. And as I started reading it, I was just horrified at what I was reading. And it turned out that even back in 2002, they knew that this was an asset-backed securities. This was on commercial, actually with multifamily dwellings, mortgages on that. And they were already showing a 7% default rate. They were keeping 7% of the interest and principal payments that were supposed to go to the bondholders back in escrow. At that time, because they didn't know how much they were going to get. And usually you would get more because people would prepay principal.
Stuart,
so you were already showing a shortage.
Stuart, we only have limited time here, but it sounds to me like you should be writing a book or at least a long article. And I'd love to have you back when you do that.
I would love to have the opportunity to do that. You're gonna hook me up with an editor or?
Well, right now I'm gonna put you on hold, and you could talk to one of my producers and work that out. I gotta get on with the show. Thank you so much for calling us. It's been fascinating.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thank you.
And a reminder that my guest in studio is Les Leopold, whose book, The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. It is published by Chelsea Green. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In this book and in an article for the Huffington Post, you advocate moving money away from Wall Street and the super rich. Well, how could you do something like that? And I wonder if you've consulted Glenn Beck about what he thinks of that idea.
Well, it's not hard to do. Getting the will to do it is what's hard to do. We actually...
Can we get the will to do anything? Looking at what's going on in Washington right now with the... whether we're talking about the health bill, whether we're talking about changing the way credit cards are allowed to operate, and I can go on and on and on.
Yeah, it's sad.
It's impossible to get anything through, and this is, again, a problem of roadblocks both among the Democrats and the Republicans.
Well, it's really a problem that the progressive infrastructure of the country is atrophied. One of the big differences between now and the 1930s was there really was a vibrant series of progressive movements that were poised to make a systemic critique and offer a vision for change. Right now, the teabaggers are offering that vision for change. It's just another anti-government onslaught that's coming, and it's really the progressive community has got to get its act together.
Do you support the proposal for a wage cap where no salaries at financial institutions shall be greater than that of the President of the United States?
Absolutely. That was one of the proposals of Looting of America. And matter of fact, I've now put a new twist on it, which is that cap should stay into effect until unemployment comes down below 5%. And the argument is simple. By the way, I've been talking
about... every corporation would scream bloody murder. You're telling us what we should pay, and all of our best people will go abroad.
Look,
and
America, let them go. Let them go. We have way too many financial engineers. That's a bogus argument. The more that went into other fields, the better. But look, the American public understands the problem of welfare. We've always been almost mean-spirited against low-income people that got welfare. Now we put $13 trillion into Wall Street. The whole sector is on welfare right now. How else could they be making record profits and record bonuses in the worst year since the Great Depression? So yes, we could put a wage cap on, and it'd be wildly popular with the American people.
You say that the subprime mortgages are not to blame for this financial crisis. That's one of the myths.
Well, I'm saying definitely that low-income people with subprime mortgages are not to blame. What the demand for subprime mortgages came from Wall Street, not from the consumer. Wall Street learned that they could package these things into huge pools and get be able to cut them up and get a higher interest rate for investors and make huge fees like that gentleman just talked about on every single part of the transaction. And so the demand for the explosion of subprime mortgages came directly from Wall Street, not from the consumer.
A listener says there are a lot of civil service workers who don't get fairly paid minimum wage, people working in cleaning, et cetera. How does that fit in?
Well, it fits into the our maldistribution of wealth. I think people are eventually going to get back to understanding this as we did 30 years ago. We knew during the Great Depression, the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, that if you let the distribution of income in this country get out of hand, you would get a speculative economy. You would get a Wall Street casino. We learned that in 1928, 29, and we thought we had memorized that lesson, which we've now forgotten. So you want to bring up the best thing you can do for the economy is bring up lower wage workers.
Les Leopold's book, The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, is published by Chelsea Green. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.